Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. Happy New Year. Did you have a good holiday season? We did here at Unpacking Peanuts, and we're more than excited to continue this podcast into 2023 and beyond.
It's 1965. The Rolling Stones are unsatisfied. The Beatles are asking for help. Lucy's being terrorized by a sentient, malevolent blanket. But there is a World War I flying ace on the scene. He's here to save the day. And I can't wait to talk about all of it with you guys. Hope you're doing well. I'm Jimmy Gownley. I'm one of your hosts for today. I'm a cartoonist as well. I'm the cartoonist behind Amelia Rules, The Dumbest Idea Ever, and Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up. Joining me, as always, are my pals, co-hosts, and fellow cartoonists. He's a playwright and a composer, both for the band Complicated People, as well as for this very podcast. He's the original editor for Amelia Rules, the co-creator of the original comic book Price Guide, and the cartoonist behind such great strips as Strange Attractors, Tangled River, and A Gathering of Spells. It's Michael Cohen.
Hey there.
And he's the executive producer and writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000, a former vice president of Archie Comics, and currently the cartoonist behind the great Instagram strip Sweetest Beasts, Harold Buchholz.
Hello.
Well, guys, this is a very, very exciting year to talk about. There is a lot going on in Schulz's mind and in his art. I think I'm looking at this as like a year of big swings, where he's taken some chances and he's going off in some unique directions. I think it's going to be a year that we look as kind of a turning point in the whole arc of the strip. Harold, what are your thoughts to start us off, both with what your experience was reading this and also, if you have any insights into Mr. Schulz or what's going on in his world?
Yeah, 1965 is a really big year for Charles Schulz. He makes the cover of Time magazine on April 9th. I think I'd said in a previous episode that he had been on the cover of Time magazine much earlier. I think that was incorrect. This is the time he does it, and it's entitled The World According to Peanuts. You get some sense of the impact that Peanuts is having on American culture to make the cover of Time magazine. And 8 months later, on the 9th of December, the Peanuts Christmas special comes out. Charlie Brown Christmas and it debuts to tremendous response. And it goes on to win an Emmy and a Peabody Award for Outstanding Children's Show. So huge impact that Schulz is having 15 years in to this strip. And that's something that, we can really kind of track in the strips and see the sense of confidence in his work in 1965. He just seems to be at the top of his game. And that's my memory as well as a kid is, when I would be reading these in the 1970s, I would go and look at the copyright page because they would tell you what years these strips came from in these Fawcett Crest mass market paperbacks that I would be reading as a little kid. And whenever I saw like 1964, 65 as the copyright for most of the strips in that year, that was the book to get because those were the ones I just loved the most. In his personal life, Schulz now has two teenagers. Meredith is 15, Monty's 13, Craig is 12, Amy's 9, and Jill is 7. So this is a prime school years ranging anywhere from elementary up through high school. And, I think you can see that in the strips. There's lots of in the weeds strips about going to school and the PTA. And you also get that sense of having older kids and the concerns of having teenage kids in the strips. We can talk about that, I guess, as we go along, but there's romance starts to kind of enter into these strips through Snoopy. And it's a really interesting year to see Schulz living with children of all different ages. I think it does come out in the strips this year.
Yeah, I actually really agree with that. There's a few instances in the strips that we're going to be discussing where I thought, oh, that has to be something that he was dealing with at home. So Michael, what are your thoughts on 1965? And do you think we're going to have any fluctuation in the old tier list of characters?
I agree. It's a pivotal year. And I think we're getting some indications that he's going to kind of expand the Peanuts world a little bit. It doesn't happen big time, but there is a character, a new character introduced who would be the first temporary character. We'll talk about it more when we get to the strip. But since we know that the strip is going to expand into the whole world of Marcy and Peppermint Patty sometime in the near future, we have some indications of him taking it out of the neighborhood, where so far just about everything has happened. Mm-hmm. And we go out in the world a little bit. And as far as the list goes, it's pretty much status quo. With the A-list here would be Charlie Brown, Lucy, Linus, and Snoopy, which has been consistent the whole time. These are the characters who appear, well, at least one of them will appear in virtually every strip. And we've had a few exceptions where a strip would not have those four characters in it. And then the B list would be Schroeder. I would put Frida there. And I think we place Sally in the second tier, but she doesn't appear very much this year, not till the end of the year.
She makes an impact when she does, though.
Yeah, yeah. So I'd keep her in the second tier. Patty and Violet have look like they've been demoted to third tier. And it's a little strange because the two of them always came together, but it looks like Violet seems to be showing up a lot more than Patty. And then down in the basement, we've got Pigpen and Shermie, who rarely have anything to say and no real impact on their association with the other characters. They're kind of just there when he needs some people. But anyway, I'd say tier list, I'd leave it as is for this year, but I know changes are coming soon, and I'm keeping an eye on that.
Yeah, and it's sort of interesting. I forgot exactly how the Peppermint Patty universe opens up, and you're right. It's through this this new character that's introduced this year. While I was reading this, a couple things have changed in the way I've kind of looked at Peanuts since we started talking about it. One of the things, actually, since we started doing the tier list, is I started noticing the gaps where you don't see certain characters. You know, they don't appear for weeks at a time, sometimes months at a time, even though they're quintessential, really important Peanuts characters overall. You know, Schroeder, there's not a whole lot of Schroeder going on. Like you said, Sally doesn't appear much in the early half of the year, and she comes on strong at the end. And he's also balancing this thing of playing the hits now, because he has a number of hits. We have the baseball things, we have the psychiatry booth, we have the kite eating tree, we have all this kind of stuff that's now getting into the pop culture that he's still has to include in the strip in order to maintain that readership interest in all those things, while at the same time he's taking big swings and going off into weird magic realism and weird fantasy elements and all this sort of stuff. But I still think he manages to keep the core of it, which is kind of amazing. And then when you think, all right, he's doing that, but he's also working on this television show, which is going to be like the greatest television episode of all time. It's astounding. And I think I have a question for Michael. Were years longer in the 60s or something? What? How can you? How do people do this type of thing? It's nuts.
Yeah, years were longer.
All right. Well, that just explains so much.
Yeah, you know? No, it's been proven.
Okay, good.
Yeah, and I won't go into the whole Beatles things, but...
Right, but you can't avoid
culture
that.
The culture was changing pretty fast, and you can think of very few people who were really steering it, and I think Schultz was one of them.
15 years into his career.
Yeah.
That's, you know, as a cartoonist, you would think at this point, these characters would look ancient, right? They would have some of this early 50s sort of residue, and 65 is a totally different zeitgeist. It's a totally different time, but they're even more relevant while being true to what they've always been. I just think that's amazing.
And there's a lot of pop culture references
yes
this year.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing which obscurities Harold has picked out. I have one myself this year. I'm very excited about it.
This is just an unusual year because Michael and I picked the strips to discuss every year, and Michael actually picked a couple of the obscurity strips that I choose. Usually those are not ones that we overlap on, and Michael's came through the first time. So I actually had a couple opportunities to add some additional obscurities because he had picked strips to talk about that I had selected as obscurity. So that's very unusual.
Well, and also one of the ones you picked is one that I didn't get it. There's a reference to something I have no memory of.
Oh, wow.
So when we get to that, maybe you can do an explainer.
Okay. Yeah, we'll see. Actually, it may be something I know nothing about either. It's just one I thought was funny.
And I, as a spoiler, I'm going to make a shocking allegation.
Oh, my gosh.
A really shocking allegation at some point.
Excited.
Yeah.
So excited. Oh, that's why we do the podcast. Hot takes. Hot takes on 60-year-old comic strips.
Hang in there. It's coming.
So are there any other points of order, any other things people want to discuss about this year before we get into the nitty gritty? We have, I believe, like 45 strips selected for you guys. So there's going to be a lot of it, but I also want to get any kind of general discussion out of the way before we get into that.
I was describing the circumstances that I had been reading most of these.
Yes.
I mean, I knew I read them all daily because being an old person, there was this thing called a newspaper, which was delivered every day
strange.
To our house. And so I did read them, but also I had what I thought was all the books, the original first prints of the original Peanuts collections. And I noticed last year when I was reading the strips that I was not that familiar with around half of them. And I was wondering, I thought maybe I'd missed one of the books, and because I knew I read, you know, all the books dozens and dozens of times, and there were a bunch that were unfamiliar to me going over last year's strips. Same on this year, the first half of the year, I don't remember any of these. And the thing is, what I think it's important is I'd been wondering how much nostalgia played into this, like, uh-huh. Did I love these so much because I read them so much when I was a kid? Right. And I found that the first half of the year, which I had no memory of, was just as good. And that kind of shut down the nostalgia theory. And also it added a lot of suspense in some of these strips. Like, God, what's going to happen next?
It's so great. This will be really the third time I've kind of actually read it all the way through. But there's some of these strips, it's only the second or third time I've actually read them. So they're not as ingrained as the others. And you're right. When there is a sequence that you're not super familiar with, it is kind of cool. It's like, ooh, this feels like a new one. Wow. And there's not too much of that in these strips, because I know Michael and I in particular had most of them memorized. But Harold, this is your era too. So one of the things I enjoy, I don't pick the strips generally that we're going to single out and discuss, but as I read the whole year to myself, I try to predict which ones that the other guys are going to choose. And I'm usually, I have a good sense of it. I could probably guess like 80% of the ones they're going to pick, but that extra 20% when I'm really surprised, like, oh, they went with that one. That's always very fun. For me.
Yeah. Sometimes I won't pick one because I go, this is a Harold.
Yeah. Strip. Same here. Same here. It's like you have to hold out for the other person to put the nominations in so that you have, oh, I overlap with Michael on six strips, so I can choose six more, you know?
And then I also like, Michael sends me an entire document with just the strips selected from Go Comics. And I just do a quick scroll through. I just swish my finger just to see how many they picked. And it's always a lot.
This year's much less than usual.
We have 45. How many do we normally do?
60 or so.
60. No. Well, We're doing a lot of, there's a lot of longer stories. And I think that's going to happen as we go through, where there's a few sequences. And we, you know, for copyright and whatnot, we never do an entire sequence. Yeah. But yeah, it's fun. I always like to see which ones you guys pick.
And for the record, I only pick 15, but I really respect Michael's choices. So I think it balances out pretty well.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And some of these long, you know, 2 week long episodes are really great. And we're picking three to discuss. But right. I mean, if you've got the Go Comics, definitely go and read the whole sequence.
Right. And that is exactly what we would love for you to do is, you know, we're trying to read the whole thing. We started in October 1915. We're going right through to the end, and we would love your company. So if you want to, you can sign up for the Great Peanuts Reread over on our website, unpackingpeanuts.com. And what that'll do is you will get a monthly email sent direct to you from us that will give you a heads up about the programming that we're doing and what strips we're going to be covering in each episode. And then you could just go to gocomics.com, type in the dates of the years we're talking about, and away you go. You could read every one of these strips for free. But the best way to do that, at least following along with us, is to sign up for that Great Peanuts Reread at unpackingpeanuts.com. So that's what I would encourage you guys to do. If that's all we have in way of introduction, I say we get right to it, because I think we're going to have a lot to say about a lot of these strips. Are you guys with me?
Yeah.
Yep, let's do it.
All right. January 8th. Violet and Patty are sitting on little stools in front of a television set. Patty looks at Violet and says, "You have very nice hands, Violet." Violet responds, "Thank you." Patty says, "I think nice hands are important for a girl." Patty stands up and looks disgustedly at her own hands, saying, "I don't like my hands. They're too skinny." Then she asks Violet, "What can you do to gain weight in your hands?" "Oh, no, this is a momentous occasion."
Well, I picked it not because it's like the funniest strip he's ever done, but Patty and Violet, who were very important, and actually Patty was one of the first characters in the strip, have been treated badly by Schultz lately and sort of being relegated to like walk on, you know, appearances. And here Schultz, you know, 15 years into the strip, gives him a big feature. And again, it's very, very rare that there are any strips without the A-list characters. Again, Charlie Brown, Linus, Lucy, and Snoopy. And we've had, I think there was a Sally, and I think there was a Schroeder standalone. And I don't know if there's ever been a Patty and Violet standalone. And so he really felt he needed these characters for this. I don't know if the gag came first or he felt he wanted something with those two in it, but here it is.
And this is the very first of what you might call the teenager strips, where it just kind of feels like something that might have been a conversation between some teenagers.
I was going to say that punchline is such a weird thing. It sounds like the kind of thing a teenage girl in the mid-60s would say that their father might overhear and roll their eyes at.
Yeah. And here we have the two nastiest characters in the Peanuts universe.
Oh, right.
And they're just so nice to each other.
You have very nice hands, Violet. If she would have complimented Charlie Brown on his hands, he would have fainted dead away. January 9th. Linus is reading the newspaper. He's concerned. He says, "I can't stand it." Then, with a look of worry on his face, he gets to classic thumb and blanket position. He says to himself, "This is terrible." He picks up the newspaper again. "How depressing." Then he shouts to the heavens, "Annette Funicello has grown up."
Well, I mean, there's a point where kids realize that their people age and change. I mean, at first, they probably assume, "Oh, I'm a kid. I guess that's my lot in life." And it's pretty scary when you start realizing it. And Annette was one of the first cases where she went from Mickey Mouse Club to being, you know, a teen surfer girl in these movies.
Yeah, the beach party movies. And So this is 1965, and I guess the story goes that she was discovered by Walt Disney himself. He attended some event where she was, I think, dancing. She was like 5 feet, just over 5 feet. And she was dancing at this event, and he noticed her, and that led to her getting an offer to audition for the Mickey Mouse Club, and which debuted, I think, in 1955. So where this is like 10 years later. And she was the last one hired, apparently, of all of the kids. They had like 24 kids that they signed up for the Mickey Mouse Club, which was a daily show that was on in the afternoons and became a huge, huge success for Walt Disney Company. But she was the standout. She was the breakout star. People just fell in love with Annette, and she went on to be featured in a number of, like, I think they did a little Annette series, and they ran her in the Wonderful World of Disney, which had multiple different names. It's probably called Disneyland back in the day. And so she was super popular in the Disney universe. And then in 1963, she was probably like 20 years old, and American International Pictures, which was known for some pretty schlocky films, including the I Was a Teenage Werewolf films we talked about in previous episode. And they wanted to work with her, but she was under contract with Disney. And surprisingly, Disney said, yeah, she can be in this Beach Party movie in 1963 while she was still under contract to Disney, because I guess she wanted to do it and she was 20 years old. And so she went on to do a number of these with Frankie Avalon, which became really iconic movies of the time. I think they say his only requirement was that she had to wear like a one-piece bathing suit or something, so that she had some level of Disney respectability within the American International Pictures film. But she overlapped, I think, from 63 to 65 with Disney, still making movies with her, with things like The Monkey's Uncle. And we always talk about how Schultz will change how Snoopy looks pose to pose. This is an absolute extreme. Again, this is January 18th, 1965. If you are not looking at a strip, you may want to pull this one up to see just to what extremes Charles Schultz will go in changing the look of Snoopy when he does a different pose for him. In the first panel, we've got classic Snoopy with the incredibly thick neck and the big stomach lying on the back of his doghouse. By panel three, literally his neck is one quarter the width of what it was in panel one, and there's no stomach as he's standing on his head. And then in panel four, to put it over the gag of him kind of resting on his neck down the side of his doghouse, he's about a third larger than what he normally is. It seems like he would be filling the entire doghouse if he was lying on his back in that one. So he's all over the map here in terms of the size and the shape of Snoopy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But it works as a reading experience to go right through it. I always like to see a lot of black in a Peanuts strip just because it's so rare. Looks good. And speaking of night strips, that brings us to January 25th. It's a full moon on a dark night, and Snoopy is down at a skating pond. He's doing a little late night skating. He thinks to himself, "Every night I come down here and skate around, hoping to meet a beautiful girl beagle. But it looks like suddenly he is brought up short in his skating." He looks off panel and thinks to himself, "Good grief, there she is." So this is the beginning of a long sequence of Snoopy and his beautiful girl beagle skater.
I wanted to see her.
How about you, Harold?
This is Schultz does this sometimes. Again, this is one of those oddball things about Schultz that, and you just roll with it when you're reading it, that Snoopy decides that the place to go to meet a girl beagle is on the ice skating at night. That's the way he's going to find a girl beagle. And he does.
Yeah. And not an ice rink, a frozen pond out in the middle of the tundra. It looks like.
Yeah. It's like Schultz is like, I don't know. It's weird. Like, you talk about Schultz being a character in his own strip. The totally implausible thing that Schultz sets up for Snoopy, longing for something, and then he fulfills the longing. It's like he produces the girl beagle who should never have shown up given the setup.
Right. So it continues. January 27th, Snoopy is lying atop his doghouse. It's now day. It's a snowy day, worth noting that we're in the depths of winter. Charlie Brown comes out to him and says, "Answer me truthfully, Snoopy. Have you been down to the rink skating with a girl beagle?" Snoopy rolls over in his stomach, then contemplates the question while he thinks to himself, "Have I been down to the rink skating with a girl beagle? That's a good question. Have I been down to the rink skating with a girl beagle?" Then in the last panel, his ears are perked up, a huge smile on his face, and he thinks to himself, "Wow, have I ever?" And Charlie Brown rolls his eyes and says, "Oh no."
You got to imagine this strip, since Charlie Brown does not hear Snoopy.
Mm-hmm.
If Schultz had decided early on that Snoopy, we would not hear his thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie Brown would not hear his thoughts. Imagine this strip without the Snoopy dialogue there. is it understandable?
I think so. I mean, maybe not why he waits so long to respond.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but I would say you definitely can tell, obviously, from Snoopy's demeanor. He's now walking on his hind legs. His ears are perked up like a rabbit's, the big goofy grin on his face, that's an affirmative to Charlie Brown's question.
And it's also, again, this Schultzian logic where you've got Charlie Brown trying to get the straight scoop from Snoopy of whether he's been out at night, not only out at night skating, but out at night skating with a girl beagle. I don't know if he's heard the word from Shermy, who was walking by, that this is happening. We don't know exactly how Charlie Brown has heard about this. And the other thing that really stands out to me is that Charlie Brown is talking about calling this pond a rink. And, you know, Schultz is a transplanted Minnesotan, loved skating, loved hockey and all that stuff. And he's now in Santa Rosa area in California. And he's 4 years out from having built the skating rink that is still, I think, around to this day, because they didn't really have one. And so he built this beautiful skating rink in 1969. But given how long it takes to get stuff like that done, I wouldn't be at all surprised if this is around the time he first started thinking about, hey, I need a place to be able to skate and the community needs something like this. And so that he calls it a rink, I think, is really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, and how old did you say Meredith was?
Meredith is 15.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right?
And listen, Meredith, if you're listening, no shame. I got into all kinds of shenanigans. That's perfect sneaking out at night age bracket. So all good.
Oh, and I do want to also mention the first 2 months of the strips in 1965. The thing that struck me, we haven't hit the school ones yet, but there are 10 school strips in the first 2 months, and there are 25 strips about growing up or romance. 25 out of about 60 strips. That is amazing. It's the Snoopy meeting the girl. It's Annette Funicello. It's, you know, all this teenage stuff is kind of coming in. That vibe is just all over the beginning of this year.
And what's really interesting about it is when people say, like, did you get ideas from your kids or do you get ideas from? I mean, it's kind of in a way truthful to say, well, no, in the sense that none of these things happened. None of his kids were sneaking out to a weird pond to meet a girl beagle. Right. But you're just marinating in all this life that's going on around you.
Yeah.
And you have this one creative outlet that everything is getting funneled to, and it's happening every single day. There's no way to avoid having all of that stuff go into it, but there's like good ways and bad ways to do it, you know? And I think like, this is a great way to bring in all that teenage youthful energy. I think it, while still, you know, maintaining the privacy and the dignity of the kids.
Exactly.
They're never, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. That the right answer, if there's an honest way to answer it, is no. You know, there is, you know, I'm not taking this from the lives of these people, because then it'll inspire people like me to go and guess which things were based on what. And that's right. that really does take you into places sometimes you don't want to go. And I get that. That is the correct answer. And just for everybody to remember, and they're in Sebastopol on this beautiful multi-acre campus that Joyce has continually been building out as a play place for the kids, essentially. And as you might expect, that means that there were a lot of the kids, not just the five kids that they had, but a lot of their friends were coming out to play on, you know, they've got a little three-hole golf course. They've got tennis courts. They've got, I mean, it's nice. And so you can imagine what Schultz is surrounded by in this world that he and Joyce have created.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing I'd just like to say for these kids, to grow up in that kind of luxury at that period of time and all turn out to be decent, you know, kind, cool people, it seems, from every report you get, is not only a testament to them, but it's a testament to their parents and their step parents that it worked out. Because a lot of stories of privilege of that type, it doesn't work out quite as well. But in Peanuts Land, the story's continuing. And that was the 27th of January. We're now all the way up at February 4th. Snoopy is out at night again. Still a full moon, by the way. So not sure how that's happening.
What planet is this?
And Snoopy says, well, it's definitely a different planet because the gravity is different, because Snoopy's well off the ground as he's walking down.
He's in love. Yeah.
He thinks to himself, I've never been so nervous in all my life. He continues to think as he races for the pond. Tonight, I'm going to ask my little beagle friend to marry me. He skates out onto the pond. He thinks to himself, we'll skate through life together. Then he looks directly out at us with a ridiculous grin on his face, wearing a giant stocking cap. And he says, wish me luck.
This one bothers me a little.
All right.
I mean, it's the breaking the fourth wall. And this is not a good strip.
To me, it feels like marking time and building the idea of that this is an event, like almost like giving it an extra day so people could talk about it or something like that. Uh-huh. Like to hear Snoopy's getting married. But I know what you're saying. I definitely
understand. I'm a huge fan of breaking the fourth wall when it's done well. And here, I love
too.
Snoopy so much that I'm delighted that he's asking me to wish him luck, because I'm wishing him luck.
Well, I've destroyed the fourth wall. I mean, I have no problem with that so much as maybe it just feels like it's a beat too long within the story. But I would really encourage everybody to read this entire story, you know, because it also involves Charlie Brown giving his permission to Snoopy to marry this girl beagle. But there's also a moment where Charlie Brown says something like, oh, my dog's finally cracked up. And you think, wait, is Snoopy hallucinating this girl beagle? It's just a very, very odd story. Yeah. And we have not chosen, because that's us, we have not chosen to cover the actual strip where we find out the resolution.
So
but does anyone want to tell us, does Snoopy get married?
Well, first, Michael, I just wanted to ask, like, going back to the breaking the fourth wall, do you just like to see a world that's self-contained and does not include the reader? Do you mind like Oliver Hardy looking at us at the screen and during a Laurel and Hardy, or is it just I just was wondering like where you're coming from as to what you like?
Well, I am actually not a big Laurel and Hardy fan. No, I have no problem. I mean, Jimmy, you know, he breaks the fourth wall all the time. I've sort of done it, but not very much. I don't know. It's just that it's kind of a teaser.
Right. That's a good way to put it.
How do you mean
it's
teaser?
Like a little bit of a cliffhanger. Like you want to find out what happens.
Okay. So basically it's putting off moving it forward.
Right. Right. But having said that, like if I was not analyzing this for a Peanuts podcast and was just reading it in the newspaper, you know, I'd be on the edge of my seat to see what's happening. And the drawing of Snoopy in that last panel is about as cute a drawing. He so rarely gives us that Snoopy looking directly at us view.
And he's so
effective.
Open, you know, he's open. You know, he's vulnerable. You know, right. your heart kind of goes out to this Snoopy. He's put all of his, he's not being guarded or cynical or selfish, or it's just this open, he's been touched by love, you know, and it's pretty cool to see.
And, you know, the meta narrative, because we're familiar with Peanuts and how things work, we kind of know how it's going to work.
Yeah.
Which is to say it's not going to work.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the strips I'd never seen before. And when I got to these and I'm reading them and, you know, it's like 2 weeks worth, I was really going to wondering, is he going to show the girl Beagle? Yeah. Because I had no memory of this.
And Jimmy, you mentioned the thing about the full moon. When you read these, do you kind of get the feeling that without it saying otherwise, that if you're going from day to day, it actually is a new day in the Peanuts world if you're reading it in the strip the next following day?
Well, you know, I don't have the entire sequence in front of me, but obviously when it's like switching day to night, it has to be a new day. There, if there's a couple sequences of days in a row or nights in a row, that those could be moment to moment. But clearly, like, you know, let's say we looked at 125, it's night, 127, it's day. Charlie Brown has says, you know, have you been down to the rink skating with the girl Beagle? So, yeah, I mean.
So it should be waning gibbous is what you're saying. In this
point. That's what I'm saying. And basically, I've given up any hope of making any sense of this comic strip at this point.
It could be a balloon.
It's a weather balloon. They always say it is.
Or a UFO.
Actually, I think the answer is it's always a full moon in comic strips, unless you're in like Crazy Cat. If you're going to draw a moon, you might as well draw the big full moon and get the nice value.
For some reason, I'm a crescent guy because I can't draw a good circle.
I draw a lot of crescents as well. But of course, it doesn't work out for Snoopy. And here we are on February 9th. Patty comes up to Charlie Brown and says, "You say Snoopy is eating to forget his broken romance?" Patty continues, "That sounds like a good idea." Charlie Brown says to Patty, "It has its drawbacks." Then in the last panel, we see Snoopy atop his doghouse. His stomach is swollen to twice the size of his head, and he looks more than a little upset.
Yeah, that's a great little picture of little fatty Snoopy there.
It really is. Those tiny little back paws.
Oh, yeah. Poor little Snoopy. So I want to ask you about Patty, Michael. So Patty is clearly taller than Charlie Brown here. So is that always been established that she's
he came in as the kid. He was younger.
Right. Yeah. So she's kind of, is she younger than Shermie, you think, but older than Charlie Brown?
I think there was like a year difference, which at the time was a big deal because he was definitely a kid. And Schultz just kind of always maintained those height relationships.
And I think Charlie Brown at this year, there's a strip where he's talking to Lucy, I think at the psychiatry booth. And is it something like she's saying something has to happen by the age of 5? And he says, "I'm much older than 5. So we get a hint that maybe he's 6 or 7 now.
I think 6.
Yeah, he doesn't say much older. He just says older. It's, you know, your personality traits are all set by the time you're 5. And he says, "But I'm already 5. In fact, I'm older than 5.
And my other Patty question is, why is he using Patty here for this conversation with Charlie Brown?
I think it's guilt. It's got to be guilt. She was in the first couple of strips. She was like,
she's the second person to speak.
Girl in the strip, she was a very important character, and he's obviously feeling like, oh god.
my thought was, I was like, I need a character who's going to ask a question, but I don't want the audience to think about what they would think about the response from Charlie Brown, so it has to be somebody we don't know. Yeah. So I'm going to use Patty. That was my theory.
Well, it's a perfect Shermie setup, and I'm surprised he didn't do it.
Which is you know, it brings us to sad news. We do not have a Shermie strip to cover this year.
Oh.
It's just terrible. You know, but we may, by the end of it, still check the Shermometer just to check in on him, because I can't let go of it that easily. But no Shermie this year.
Well, he will be in 2 strips, but just as one of the gang.
As the bystander.
One of the gang. February 13th. Lucy is hanging out at Schroeder's piano. Schroeder's plinking away. Lucy says to him, "Tomorrow is Valentine's Day." Then she turns, a big smile on her face as she rests her elbows on the piano and says, "Are you going to give me a Valentine?" Schroeder immediately goes back to practicing and says, "I never have. What makes you think I'll give you one this year?" Lucy shouts as loud as she can, "Hope!"
This is a classic strip of all of the Schroeder Lucy strips at the piano. This is one I remember really well, and I just I love, because Lucy is she's in a good mood all the way through. She's not at all deflated by what Schroeder says, and it's just, again, it's interesting to see. Once again, this is one of the growing up romance strips of the first 2 months that is just so common in these strips.
I really like the expression on Lucy's face in the last panel, yeah, where she's clearly is hopeful.
Yeah.
You know, it's great. It's really, really cute.
And this is Lucy at her most vulnerable, is always in front of Schroeder. So it's good to see that side of Lucy. I think it really softens our opinion of her to see that, mm-hmm, there's somebody that she would love to have a connection with that she's not getting.
You're really starting to see how rubbery and abstract the figures are. Like when you look at Lucy's arms in that third panel, you know, it's just a tighter, like Thurber arm almost. You know, there's no defined elbows. They're all just curves. Looks really good, really sharp, very modern drawing.
Yeah. And it's one of the few times where it looks like maybe we've got the four finger animation hand instead of the five finger hand, which she usually shows.
I think that's the pointer finger. No, I don't know.
What's that?
I thought but actually in the last panel, yeah, I guess you can see it that way. Interesting. February 21st. It's a Sunday. Snoopy is atop his doghouse. He thinks to himself, "I feel strange." He jumps off the doghouse and thinks to himself, "I feel very loving today. I think I'll kiss somebody on the cheek." That's not a great impulse to act on Snoopy, but he does. He goes up and he kisses Lucy on the cheek, who is just sitting there reading a book. She looks shocked. She shouts to the heavens, "Ugh, somebody get me some soap and water. I've just been kissed by a dog." Now Lucy is standing up, running around and ranting, "Get hot water, get some disinfectant, get some iodine." Snoopy thinks to himself, "Good grief." Then goes back to the top of his doghouse and says, "Next time I'll bite her on the leg."
So, Harold, is this one of the romance comic strips you were talking about?
Yeah, things are getting all smoochy and lovey-dovey all through these opening months.
Hashtag Peanuts. Consent, Snoopy. Hashtag consent. Wow.
Oh, there's a dog for you, boy. They're just going to just go for the smooching.
Okay, so here's a weird thing.
Yeah, this is weird.
Oh, no, go ahead. What's your weird thing?
Well, the next strip is thematically tied in.
Yeah, that is weird. What I was just going to say is that suddenly it's summer again. There's full-on hedges that seem that they've never been covered by snow. There's leaves on the tree. And I wonder when he makes the decision to do stuff like that, to be like, all right. I mean, the last sequence that we've studied with the little girl beagles, all based on the fact that it's the dead of winter. And now it's like 2 weeks later and suddenly it looks like it's the middle of June.
Yeah. Hey, it's California, man.
Oh, that's right. I guess
he's totally
Hennepin County, bouncing, California.
He's bouncing back and forth. And we see later, we see some things that could not have happened in Hennepin County.
For sure.
So yeah, it's interesting that, yeah, Schultz, he's going back from his childhood memories in Minnesota, and then he's hopping back into his life in California, and you know,
I buy it as
a reader.
It's the Hennepin County of the mind.
Yes. Oh, this is also a famous sequence from the Christmas special,
yes.
They would have written probably just about, I don't know, about 5 months or so after he created this. So this one was on his mind and is a very funny one and works incredibly well in the animated special. It's one of the classic, many classic sequences in the Christmas special is Lucy running around going nuts after being smooched by Snoopy.
Very cute. And like Michael says, thematically attached daily strip here on February 25th. Lucy sticks her tongue out at Snoopy, says, "Bleh." Snoopy sticks his tongue back out, saying bleh. They both do it at the same time in panel two. Bleh, bleh. Only this time their tongues touch. Then Lucy goes running around like a lunatic again, saying, "Og, our tongues touched. My tongue touched the tongue of a dog. I'm poisoned." In the last panel, Snoopy is sitting there with his tongue out, and he thinks to himself, "Bleh, I feel a little nauseated myself."
Ugh, I feel nauseated just thinking about this.
Yeah. It's like the Lucy Jean Simmons panel.
Oh, so creepy. Have we talked about the time I met Gene Simmons on the show?
I don't think so.
Jesus.
So, Michael, you were there.
No, I wasn't. Oh, did he go to a con?
Yeah, yes. It was maybe you weren't there when he popped by, but you were at the convention. It was the very first time we exhibited out in San Diego. And Amelia, we only had one issue of Amelia out and one issue of the Forbidden Book out. We had a booth in San Diego Comic Con, and I was like so nervous. I'd never even been to the convention before. I wanted to put my best foot forward. Suddenly, some kid who I'm talking to, right, he just stops our conversation. He goes, "Gene Simmons," and there's Gene Simmons from Kiss, and he comes over like, "Oh man, oh you're my favorite. I love Kiss." And this is before there were cameras on your phone. So he's like, "Can you take a picture with me?" And sure. So Gene Simmons takes all his crap that he's carrying and throws it on top of all my books I'm trying to sell. And then him and this knucklehead are standing in front of my booth getting their picture taken, and someone in front of them is taking the picture. And if anyone out there is listening, and if you can find this picture, because somewhere out there is this kid with his arm around Gene Simmons, and they're both smiling, and there's me in the background giving them both the finger. So if anyone can find that,
yeah,
send it to Unpacking Peanuts.
That's called putting your best foot in your mouth.
Your best tongue in your mouth.
I just love that he's like, "I can't wait to get that Gene Simmons picture back," because you had to get developed back in those days.
Yeah. Well, try a Google image search.
It's probably on Etsy as a 20 by 24 print.
I would buy that.
I bet you would.
March 4th. Linus and Charlie Brand are outside. Linus is looking at some piece of paper in his hand, and he says, "Well, I'll be." He continues to look at the piece of paper. He looks very concerned, and he says to Charlie Brown, "I guess I'm going to have to get on the ball. Look at this." He hands the paper to Charlie Brown. Then he says, "I'm the only person I know who got a cinch notice for lunch eating."
Okay. I have no idea what this is all about.
Well, that makes this a Peanuts obscurity.
Peanuts obscurity explained.
All right. Very exciting.
Okay.
Hit us with it, Harold.
Here we go. So the cinch notice is, from everything I could find out online, which is not much, is a term that it was just used only, and people can correct me, you're listening, if I'm wrong, seemed to only be used in the general San Francisco area. And it was but I think Schultz didn't know that when he wrote this joke. So looking into this, I was trying to find, of course, whenever you do the search for this thing and you type in cinch notice, what comes up first? Peanuts.
That's exactly what I did because I didn't know what it was either.
But looking into it a little bit further, I found this really interesting tiny article in the Stanford Daily, the Stanford University, which is, again, just outside of San Francisco. It's about an hour's drive from Sebastopol. And this is from November 25th, 1933. It says the scholarship committee reports that a large number of students have received smoke-ups. There were 372 of them sent to as many unfortunate people, and 42 even more unlucky individuals made the big splurge of earning two or more smoke-ups apiece.
What is that?
But it's like within the headline of this thing of cinch notices. So apparently there is this thing going on in school in this area that you're being given some sort of a note. And I when you think of cinch, I can only guess at what this means, but I'm guessing it's like, you got to tighten your belt. Mm-hmm. You got to get your act together is what this is supposed to mean. So you would be getting a note from the school saying, here's a warning. You're not going to be doing well if you don't do better in school.
And everybody has those. We just call them failure warnings or failure notices.
Yeah. So it's like to buckle down or whatever, to cinch. And I did find as recent a reference in the Mission Valley Regional Occupational School in their program in 2010, there was a faculty handbook where it talked about how you had to provide a cinch notice. If you were going to fail a student, you had to give them warning. So it was this weird thing. And again, that's like near San Jose, right in the same spot, right where Schultz is living. He just happens to get what sounds like it's a great term. And I'm assuming, you know, Schultz is saying, well, this must be a thing right now. And it's all over the country. And it just happened to be in this tiny little pocket.
Well, I was going to school in California at this time. I'd never heard it.
Yeah, I think
it's super low.
That
super
was in low. L.A. Yeah,
but you know what? It is a great term, and he knows it's going to sound great in a comic strip. He can imagine Linus saying it. You know, it's just that in this instance, nobody knew what he was talking about. But he used the unnecessary quotation marks, which I am a huge fan of.
So when you read this, did that idea come across that you pretty much get that it's some sort of a, or is it just completely like, oh, I have no idea what this strip is about?
I don't really remember this from being a kid, so I probably would have, if I did see it, I just glossed over it. And then this time reading it, I looked it up.
Probably was not reprinted.
Probably.
Yeah, maybe he learned that it was super local. March 17th. Linus is standing in his living room in classic thumb and blanket position. Lucy is looking on. She's scowling and upset. She says, "Now look here." In panel two, she's yelling at Linus, saying, "When you're not around, you keep that blanket locked up in your room. Do you hear me? It's a menace. It hates me." In the third panel, Linus is standing in front of the closet door and says, "Okay, how's that?" And in the last panel, we see the blanket sneaking out from underneath the locked closet door.
It's the blob.
Yeah, I love he's doing a horror strip for these few... This ran for a while. Actually, we're coming in the middle. Yeah, this blanket turns in. I mean, for good reason, hates Lucy. Well,
Michael, give us the whole setup of what this sequence is about.
Well, Harold mentioned it's The Blob, which was one of the most popular horror flicks.
But in the context of these strips, what is happening with the blanket and Lucy and everything?
It's sentient. The blanket hates Lucy. And it's turned into some kind of horror creature.
The fact that you like this blows my mind. Blows my mind. I was reading these last night and thinking, oh my God, Michael must hate these strips, and we're just going to talk about how terrible they are. I can't believe you like it. Harold, what are your thoughts about these?
I remember this as a kid, and I remember, boy, this had a huge impact. Because, yeah, it is this creeping, crawling thing that does not like Lucy, and she's genuinely frightened by this thing.
Yeah,
it is.
This reminds me, there was a Dick Van Dyke episode that was a horror episode.
Walnuts.
Yeah, the walnuts, right? Where they're people are being like body snatched by the aliens and only eating walnuts or something like that.
I'm looking at you.
Yes, that's right. Eyes are in the back of their heads. Yes.
Yeah. So no, I would like to know why the blanket lost its sentience later. I have no problem with the blanket being a character.
So you don't mind it gaining sentience. You just want to understand why it's lost it,
or why it was just ignored afterwards. I need reasons here.
All right. Well, this is my take on it. Quentin Tarantino. I think this is obvious from reading Amelia, but one of my huge influences is Quentin Tarantino, and I was listening to an interview with him where he's talking about Brian De Palma, who's his favorite director, and they're talking about Bonfire of the Vanities. And he says, only a truly great artist could go that wrong. And that's how I feel about this sequence. Like, this was nuts to me. This whole thing I don't get, I think is weird. I'm so glad it never came back. Larry Rutman hated it at the Syndicate. He called it monster stuff. Weird. And it's so, but it's so worth talking about, because I'm totally fascinated that you liked it. I think that's so cool. And B, I want to know, you only become a great artist by risking huge failure. Like, to be a great artist is to constantly be courting failure, because you're constantly pushing at the edge of what you can do. It doesn't matter what, if you're just doing something that's very cute, but you're pushing to the absolute edge of cuteness, that's a risk. If you do something that's violent and you're pushing the violence, that's a risk. You're going to get to a part where you start maybe alienating some people, but you got to do it, because you don't know, if you don't explore, you're not going to find what fruitful stuff there is to find. And this fantasy stuff for Schultz does pay off in huge ways later.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to see how Schultz deals with this character, because it does remind me of these horror films. I mean, mainly I think of like horror and sci-fi films of the 50s, where essentially they're morality plays, sometimes in disguise and sometimes not at all in disguise, where you have somebody getting a comeuppance through some, you know, through some means that is absolutely out of people's control. And what you see in this strip is this series of strips is that you know, we know Lucy's not been kind to Linus. She's been rough on Linus. And it's like Schultz can't have Linus get the comeuppance. And so he creates something that's already in the world and imbues it with this power that is taking on Lucy, and essentially all, it's vengeance. To me, the way I read it is, it's vengeance for Linus, where Linus himself would not do the vengeance. And so, yeah. And what you see in the strips, I think this is what makes it work for those that it does work for. And these totally worked for me as a kid. Because, you know, as a kid in particular, I was just accepting Peanuts for Peanuts. I wasn't saying, well, that doesn't work here, or that, I wasn't right in that space. I was just experiencing Peanuts. And because this was happening, that was part of the world. And it was genuinely frightening, but it was in the sense like this blanket was after her because Lucy is Lucy toward Linus. And to see, and the thing that makes it work for me is, look at how Linus responds. If Linus were like, hey, this is my blanket, right, and in my blanket's going to meet justice for me, he doesn't do that. He's just as almost as frightened as Lucy is, even though he's not the one being attacked. The classic Linus hair just going straight out in the air, we see over and over again in these strips. He's genuinely shocked by this thing. And yet, well, the weird thing is, he's shocked by it, but it's not like he's trying to get rid of it. It's his blanket. It's this really weird dynamic. But if Linus was into this thing, I think it would just totally turn everybody against it. But the fact that Linus himself, this thing he's attached to, it's like this extension of himself, is somehow his id is coming out and attacking Lucy, is, you know, and you can read it that way or you don't have to, but that to me is kind of what makes it work for those that it would work for.
Well, a security guard would attack people who attack you, so I guess a security blanket should be doing the same.
Exactly. I'd like to see this as a graphic novel. Yeah, starting with, you know, the blanket being exposed to an atomic bomb test, or gamma rays or something. No, well, it's a great little story.
Well, you know, the way it does work for what you're saying is like why it gains and loses sentience. It does go back to my meta theory that, and what Harold is saying. It does, because Charles Schultz says it can for this little period of time, and then it just stops. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's like it's done what it needs to do, and so now it can go back to what it's normal. And that is so sci-fi of the 50s and early 60s.
Yeah. Now, I do have a question about the blanket, though.
Yeah.
Is it always the same blanket?
Well, it can't be, and yet it is. Because like Schultz and has talked about this actually in interviews, where it's been set on fire, it got been cut up, it's been turned into a flannel graph, it's been, all these things have happened, you know, been quilted, and you know, and yet it's the blanket all the time. Somehow it's like the Looney Tunes thing, you know, right? Where like Wile E. Coyote gets smashed, but in the neck it's just a hard cut, and then he's back.
Yeah, like Snoopy getting fat from his romance, and then two panels later he's back to his normal self.
Yeah,
right.
So I mean, Because he could always go get some outing flannel and make another one, but it's always the blanket. Yeah.
The blanket. Yeah.
Did they ever market the blanket? Did anyone ever try to actually license?
Yeah, I have one.
You're sucking your thumb right now.
Yes. It's a blue blanket. It's a light blue minus security blanket, and it has a tiny little applique Linus. It was packaged as the security blanket.
Is it outing flannel though?
Did not check that. You know, if it's not, I'm throwing it out tonight.
Yeah.
Is this a recent license thing, or is this like a classic years ago thing?
No, I mean, someone got it for me when I was an adult.
Wow.
So, I mean, you know. Yeah.
Wow. Well, it makes sense. You know, I'd never seen one, but I just seemed like it should exist in the world.
Oh, I thought you meant it makes sense for someone to give me a blanket to help aid my mental health, because that also makes a lot of sense.
So it's not working. So it's probably not outing flannel.
Oh, there you go. You know what? I think we've exposed yet another racket. Today's late.
Does the packaging say now with sentience?
Yeah, right. Actually, I can't find it. Maybe it ran away.
It's in the closet.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Be nice to your dog.
Oh, you didn't read these.
No, I didn't. But do you want me? We can read them now.
Sure, yeah, they're great.
All right. March 22nd, Lucy is in her house and she's sort of yelling to the general house. Mom, are you home? Mom, Dad, anybody home? She enters, I guess, the living room because we see a cool lamp on the table and she yells even louder. Linus, are you home? Isn't anybody home? Where is everybody? Then in panel 3, she looks very worried and she says to herself, don't tell me I'm all alone in this house with that. And in the last panel, it creeps towards her. Blanket! Then we have March 25th. Linus is in classic thumb and blanket position. Lucy is watching him. She's annoyed by this and she says, I hate that blanket and it hates me. If I get just half a chance, I'm going to throw that thing in the trash burner. In panel 3, the blanket leaps from Linus's arms, making what appears to be a giant gaping mouth who screams, Ugh! Then in panel 4, it's a brawl between Lucy and the blanket. Get it off me! Get it off me! Linus is yelling, down, boy! Down!
That picture of the blanket jumping at Lucy as if it's a gigantic open mouth, boy, is that indelibly printed in my memory from childhood. That was a big deal in Peanuts. Reading that, seeing this thing attacking Lucy is just, you don't forget that after reading it.
Brilliant. He does this so well. It's like, it's a blanket, but it's also a monster with a giant mouth attacking a kid. And he just seems to, it's the only time anyone in human history is going to need to draw this. But he has the perfect icon to do it.
Yeah. I did want to ask you guys, how are you on your speedball lettering pinpoint knowledge?
Oh, not very good.
This year, he switches over and he goes back and forth. He was usually using, I think, is it a C nib?
A C3 which is a
circular nib point, which he would use for the bolds. And what is he using usually for his general lettering?
I think it's like a B or something. I don't know.
Because in the second panel on the March 25th, he's switched over. You can, if you look at the 22nd, second panel, he's using the bold circular pen point, which I think is the B. And now he's switched over to something else. It almost looks like a magic marker to me, but it's probably a D or something. I don't know. Because there's the different points. There's one that's like almost like a straight line nib. There's another one that's a square. There's one that's circular and there's one that's oblong. I think the oblong's D, the circular's B. And I think the A might be the one that's like a chisel tip, like a calligraphy tip. And anyway, he's switched over to this other one, which I don't like as much. And I didn't think about it at all. Again, you know, growing up, it was peanuts. But now as a cartoonist, I look at that and I'm like, it for some reason, it looks like he's just gotten out a magic marker and using that lettering.
For our listeners, for what Harold's describing as a certain roundness, if you look at, let's say, the L in Linus in panel 2 on the 22nd, and you see where the strokes start and stop at the top of the L on the right side of the lower, you know, cross section of the L, you can see that it's rounded. Whereas if you look at the L or, you know, something in the 25th strip, panel two, it has a more abrupt end to the stroke. And you could tell that that's a different type of nib. But then if you see, if by the time he goes to the fourth panel of the 25th, it seems like it's back to the rounded nib
again. Yeah, yeah.
This is unrelated, but it's since we're talking about lettering, I want to bring up something we've discussed in the past. I believe I have a no prize for good old Winsor McKay to explain his crazy lettering.
Ooh, lay it on okay. us.
So we were talking and we were mentioning that Winsor McKay is one of the most, if not the most brilliant draftsman who ever lived and worked in comics. Gorgeous, gorgeous artwork. However, the lettering was always spindly, crooked. It never even stayed on the same line. It would sometimes curve up to 90 degrees and you know, morph around the shape of the word balloon. But I have a reason. If we assume he is a genius in all other ways, and we want to think that, hey, maybe he planned this out too. All of Little Nemo takes place in dreams, right?
Yeah.
And in a dream, you can meet a 20-story elephant, and you could travel to fairy, and you can fly. But you know what you can't do? Read. You cannot read in a dream. You cannot read the lettering in Little Nemo. It makes perfect conceptual sense. He's a genius across the board.
And so are you for noticing that.
Thank you.
Yeah, that is one of the great mysteries of cartooning. Is that
was
I'm so sorry. She didn't mean to in any way suggest that was not the definitive explanation.
That's it. Case closed. Conversation ended. March 28th. Snoopy is outside. He looks in anguish. His fists are clenched as he thinks to himself, what a stupid thing to do. In panel two, we see him up on his hind legs, looking in the grass, looking very upset. He says, why do things like this happen to me? In panel three, we see he's still staring at the grass. Linus is also down on his hands and knees, rummaging through the grass. Snoopy thinks to himself, this is hopeless. Linus says, we gotta keep looking, Snoopy. In the next panel, they're both still wandering around in this little field, looking at the grass. Snoopy says, rats. Still looking in the grass, Snoopy says, I'm almost at the point of despair. And he looks it, too. In the next panel, though, Linus looks happy. He's down on all fours, and he says to him, Snoopy, I found them, Snoopy, I found them. Then he holds seemingly empty hands up to Snoopy and says, here you are. Snoopy runs over saying, wow, I can't believe it. Then he clutches whatever they are to his chest and says, boy, what a relief. I'm lost without my contact lenses.
Okay. I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I had a shocking allegation.
Yes.
And I'm about to reveal what that shocking allegation is. There okay. is something seriously wrong with panel five. That is not Charles Schulz.
That I was just thinking about that panel. That to me is the first time we see Snoopy look like this. And interestingly, to your theory, that reminds me so much of certain looks I remember from the animated specials. It's like you didn't see it in the strip, but you would see it. I have memories from the specials of Snoopy looking like this. So I don't know if that sounds totally crazy, Jimmy.
I would think that something happened. He sent the strip in, someone spilled ink, and they said, okay, we got to go to press here.
To me, it's totally Schulz, but it's a new version of Snoopy we have never seen before.
It's really klutzy. And to add to that, panel three, there's something seriously wrong with the perspective.
Well, that's kind of what I love about this strip is that
it's too high.
Even if it's like he's up on a.
Where's the viewer? Where's the horizon line? I've never seen two panels in a Peanuts that look so wrong.
Are you talking about panel four and panel five?
No, three and five.
Oh, three and five. Oh, yeah, yeah. I see what you're saying with three. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the house is way, like, we've always seen the neighborhood is flat. But the house is way down a hill.
Yeah.
I think part of this might be from the fact that this is actually primarily a visual strip. But as you could tell by me even describing it, it's a visual strip where nothing is happening. It's people looking at something in the grass. I think he's trying to show ways that make it interesting from panel to panel and maybe hide the fact that we're going to find out that they're looking for contact lenses or whatever.
But
it's definitely him. I'm certain it's him.
Panel
because
five?
Of that incline.
Panel five?
Yeah, all of it.
That does not look like a dog.
Well, what do you think of panel two? Panel two is a unique and odd drawing of Snoopy. I think with he's a little fatter as he's leaned over with his arm in the middle of the body.
I mean, definitely the last two panels are just clearly Schultz totally on model. Yeah. I think something went wrong on that middle tier.
I actually love this strip because Schultz is the nature of the gag requires him to give you this sense of disorientation as you're looking for something, and it's on this difficult terrain, and I love that drawing of Snoopy in panel five.
It's not Schultz.
It's so unique.
I would bet everything I own, about $1.85, that is definitely
somebody monkeyed with that panel.
I also love panel four. I've never quite seen this before, where Snoopy is looking one direction and his little leg is going off in a different angle. Like he's like bow-legged, a really charming drawing of Snoopy in his frustration looking for this. The other thing about this strip that is kind of odd that again, Schultz does sometimes do is he goes for something that's very implausible. I'm assuming the way Linus is holding the contact lenses in the panel that follows, that somehow Snoopy has lost both contact lenses in exactly the same space, which is like, I guess there's a scenario where that would happen, but either it was a case and then he wouldn't be holding him like that. He would have found a case of contact lenses, or the contact lenses, did they both fall out of Snoopy's eyes in exactly the same spot right next to each other?
None of that matters. What matters is the fact that either Schultz was sick and had a deadline.
Yes, or I think it's rushed. I think that's the answer. It's rushed. I know fatigue on the pages when I just don't feel like it, you know, where it's just, I have to get it done and I'm going to do the best I can. It's an ungodly amount of work he's doing. We are now leading up to him getting involved in the TV thing, possibly already negotiating that stuff, whatever. Yeah, I think it's fatigue. It's weird drawings.
I would disagree.
But it's definitely Schultz.
I disagree because I think this, he's pushing himself in this strip to go places he normally doesn't go because of the nature of the gag. And he's trying to serve
the gag.
Well,
that is true.
And so we're seeing angles you don't see. We're seeing landscapes you don't normally see. And so he's inventing a lot in the strip that we've never seen
before.
Yeah, but
it's always beautiful. Panel five is ugly.
I like that drawing of Snoopy. It's an unusual one, but isn't it true to like the emotion of what he would be thinking?
I think the scribble on his paw is odd, which is, you know, Snoopy looking in the grass. I what we're basically saying is, boy, this guy, every single time, has to invent something completely new, and he does
perfection.
It perfect. And this one time it's not, maybe not perfect, right? Yeah. Well, anyway, they find the contact lenses, so all is right with the world.
Well, I hope I didn't shock anyone too much.
I those are some strong allegations, Miss Cohen.
Lord. April 3rd. Charlie Brown's out in the pitcher's mound, only this time it's covered in tiny little flowers. He says to himself, here we go, the first pitch of the season. He fires it in there, and in panel three, of course, it is fired right back at him. Pow! Sending Charlie Brown flying, and he lands flat on his back on top of the pitcher's mound and says to himself, it's kind of peaceful lying here among the dandelions. I remember these dandelion strips were epic. Seemed like a huge sequence.
Yeah, me too. The fact that dandelions grew all over the pitcher's mound is for some reason, again, one of those indelibly etched visuals that he's up against having dandelions on his pitcher's mound and what a big deal that is.
You guys did not pick the best one, though, which is where Is it in this sequence? Is that when Frida comes up and says,
"Yes,
Charlie Brown likes butter."
Yes,
that is the one that holds the little flower underneath Charlie Brown's chin adorable. And says, yeah. "Well, this will tell you if you like butter." And hey, everyone, Charlie Brown likes butter. And Charlie Brown says something like, "I wonder if my fondness for dairy products will help us win ball games." So great, so great. Speaking of great, I think this next strip, it would make my Hall of Fame peanut strips.
Yeah.
April 10th. Lucy and Linus are outside. Linus in classic thumb and blanket position. Lucy classically looking annoyed. She says to Linus, "Our generation has been given the works." In panel two, she's ranting. "All the world's problems are being shoved at us." Then Linus says, "What do you think we should do?" Then Lucy... with a look of absolute sadism on her face and a clenched fist says, "Stick the next generation."
Yeah.
Now, mission accomplished, by the way, guys.
Oh, totally. Yeah, these boomer kids.
Wow. Yeah, no offense, but you guys are the worst.
Oh, absolutely. But the best comics.
For sure. And great music.
Yeah. Anyway, this is definitely a 60s strip.
Yes.
People were not talking about generations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did they? I mean,
well, I mean, I think it was the kind of thing that certain anthropologists and people that were interested in that sort of thing were interested in. But as a pop culture phenomenon, I mean, that starts with the baby boomers and the generation gap. I mean, there was the Beat Generation, the Lost Generation. People knew these things, but now it's like ubiquitous. Like,
yeah. What's the Beat generation was not referring to that generation. It was referring to like maybe 100 people in the world.
Yeah, right.
But,
right.
You know, my generation, the Who song came out this year, didn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, 1965. Wow. Yeah.
And that might have started that whole thing of like, we're different than anything that's ever come before.
Right.
But stick it to the next generation. Stick the next generation is like, yes. Yeah, totally stick. True.
And there's no exclamation.
Stick the next generation.
No exclamation point. So that makes it even more ominous.
Yes.
For some reason.
And the look, as does the look on her face. I love this comic strip. I think it's
an amazing and frightening and wonderful strip. I mean, and again, the lettering is using that new pen point, and it looks like he doesn't quite have the feel for how much you can stick in that space. Using the term stick again, but because, you know, if he's not ruling this stuff out, he's just kind of has to wing it. And he's a little bit tight in fitting those letters in. But this strip is again, super, super memorable. It's and seeing Linus's little raised arms, like he's, there's no expression on his face, but you can tell that he's really he's set back by the intensity of
and the blanket is also set back.
Yeah.
it's ready to spring again.
Really funny.
This strip reminds me of as a kid growing up in the, you know, in the early 70s when you'd get comic books, they would often have ads for posters or patches that you could get from like the hippie generation that were like 3 or 4 years old, but they were still selling the designs. And it just reminds me of some of those kind of pseudo underground images, you know, the one that I think of here is "Do Unto Others, Then Split."
I have not thought about that in 40 years.
Split. I love the fact that we'll have a go-go showing up in a little bit.
Yeah,
it's always strange when you get those moments where he starts bringing in some current lingo.
Yeah, the term "stick." I mean, that also, you know, that makes you think of those beatnik movies, the juvenile delinquent films. You know, Shiv and
You'd think it would be "stick it too," which is the way we'd say it now, but maybe you just didn't have room.
It might be that, but it works so great.
Gosh, it's such a brilliant
"the next generation." It's so curt. I love it. April 15th. Charlie Brown is at the psychiatric booth. Lucy is listening. He says to her, "And also, when I talk to people, I find that they don't really listen to me." Charlie Brown continues, but Lucy's gaze has now shifted off to panel right. Charlie Brown says, "I find that I can't seem to hold a person's attention. When I talk to people, their minds sort of wander off and they stare into space and panel three, Lucy is still staring into space, not in the direction of Charlie Brown. In the last panel, Charlie Brown just rolls his eyes skyward and sighs. Siga.
I'm sorry. Can you read that again?
No!
You're no Charlie Brown.
That's right. All right, so there is obviously a lot we need to talk about here in 1965. So I say let's call it quits right here for part one, and then we'll come back next week and we'll finish up 1965. In the meantime, if you want to continue being a part of this Unpacking Peanuts community, there's lots of different ways you can do that. The first thing you could do is you could visit our website and you could sign up for the Great Peanuts Reread. That is unpackingpeanuts.com. That's where you can go to vote for your favorite strip of the year. You can see who's right, me, Michael, or Harold. You can tell us who you agree with. You can check out our store where you can buy books from us. There's now merchandise. You can actually buy an Unpacking Peanuts t-shirt or two, which are really fun. And you can follow us on the social media if you like it. If you're one of these Gen Z kids who's always around on your phone, you know, liking and subscribing or whatever you do on social media, you can follow us at Unpack Peanuts on both Instagram and Twitter. And we'd also really just like, if you have a chance and you want to go on Apple and give us a rating and a review, that would be hugely helpful. Another thing that would just be hugely helpful, if you like this podcast and you want to see it continue and you want more people to be a part of this fun community, just tell a friend, share it with someone. Especially, we have, you know, the Great Pumpkin episode, we have a bunch of, you know, special standalone episodes with guests. I'm sure there's something in our back catalog that can interest a friend of yours, and if you have a moment, you know, share one of those episodes with them. That would be hugely helpful to us. I'm really grateful for all the downloads we've gotten so far, all the comments and questions and everything from all you listeners out there. So I just want to see that continue and see it continue to grow. Other than that, just come back next week where we're going to continue with 1965. Until then, for Michael and Harold, I'm Jimmy. Be of good cheer.
Yes, be of good cheer.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced and edited by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. Additional voiceover by Aziza Shakrala Clark. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Twitter. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.
Good work.